Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce on Noon Forum. We'll hear the keynote address given at the Chamber of Commerce 2013 Economic Outlook Luncheon. The guest speaker will be Jeff Colvin, Senior Editor-at-Large at Fortune Magazine. He'll speak on the topic, Leading Ahead of What's Next. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, November 19, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Terry Kroger, Chairman of the Board of Directors at the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce.
Over the last 10 years, the Chamber's economic development efforts have resulted in 434 new projects, representing almost 25,000 jobs and more than $4.5 billion in fresh investment. Every year, a slate of new national rankings support these recruiting efforts. The latest highlights include, for Nebraska, number 2 on the list of top 10 pro-business states, and number 4 for quality of life. For Omaha, the information's even better. The number 1 city to raise a family, number 1 for least financial stress on households, and a top 10 city for college graduates and young entrepreneurs. And one of the top 10, quote, mid-sized American cities of the future. Not sure what that means, but it sounds really good. That's all great news, and I'm happy to report that the results of our Economic Outlook survey indicate confidence in Greater Omaha's economic growth as well. 61% of our survey respondents experienced increased sales activity for 2013 compared to 2012. 40% increased capital expenditures compared to last year, and 40% also say they will increase capital expenditures in the coming year. Looking ahead, 58% of our survey respondents expect the Greater Omaha economy to grow at a faster pace in 2014 than it did in 2013, while only 6% expect slower growth. By contrast, 27% of respondents expect the national economy to grow at a faster pace than in 2013. Through August of this year, the area's private sector added over 3,500 net new jobs. And at 4.5%, Greater Omaha's unemployment rate remains well below the national rate. You can connect those dots to see the detailed results of the survey using the QR code found on your program. So now, to give us some national perspective on economics, let's hear from our guest speaker, Jeff Colvin, about what's ahead for our economy and how it might impact your business. Colvin is an award-winning thinker, author, broadcaster, and speaker on today's most significant trends in business. As Fortune's senior editor-at-large, and I love it, I asked him at lunch what that meant, and he said, I pretty much just do the things I like now. Great job. I like that. Jeff has become one of America's sharpest and most respected commentators on leadership, globalization, wealth creation, and the infotech revolution. Ladies and gentlemen, Jeff Colvin.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you, Terry. Thank you all very, very much. Yeah, nobody actually knows what that title means. We just had to make something up at one point. Anyway, thank you, and congratulations to you also. I mean, Terry just presented a little of the data, but from an economic point of view, look, I travel all over the country all the time, and I can just tell you, if you don't know it already, that this state and this city are the envy of most of the country because you're doing so much better than most of them are. They have a lot to learn from you, and I hope they do learn from you. We got a lot to talk about, and to start off, I brought some headlines from this morning's papers because I just want to read three headlines that I think kind of set the stage for what we're going to talk about here for the next little bit. So the first one is from this morning's Wall Street Journal, and the headline says, corporate results reveal a soft underside. And then the subhead says, quarterly profits rise overall, but capital spending declines and cash piles keep growing, signaling lack of confidence. And then they quote an economist who says, businesses are sitting on record cash, capital expenditures are down. That tells you everything you need to know about the mood of executives and boards of directors. Well, so what's the point here? Why do I read this? What's the larger meaning of it? The larger meaning of it is we are in a period of uncertainty that really is unprecedented. And I'll tell you, when CEOs say that, oh, things are really uncertain, I am initially skeptical because, look, things are always uncertain, right? Life is uncertain. I mean, let's not complain. It's just always the way it is. Is this really any different? The answer is, yeah, it really is different. This really is something new, and we see it in a lot of ways, like the trillions of dollars of cash that companies are not spending, that they're just holding, and it's because they're uncertain what to do. They don't really want to be holding it all, but they don't know what to do. So we talk about what's next, our theme here. We truly do have less of an idea about what's next than we have had in a very long time, maybe ever. And the result, if we're not careful, is just what this is about, which is we get paralyzed. Uncertainty causes paralysis, so we just don't do anything. And that's no good, right? In business, we can't do that. We got to play offense, even in this environment. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. Second headline is, I got online, it's from the Wall Street Journal online this morning. Ballmer on Ballmer, his exit from Microsoft. And they quote one of the directors of Microsoft, John Thompson, who says, the directors didn't push Steve to step down, but we were pushing him hard to go faster. It's all about why he announced that he was stepping down as CEO earlier than he had planned to. Well, what's the larger point here? Why do I mention this? It's about the importance of a single individual to even a giant corporation. I mean, look, I think a CEO's worst day is when he announces he's stepping down, no successor is named, and the stock goes up, okay? And that is what happened, right? Ballmer announced he's stepping down, no successor is named. Microsoft gains $18 billion of market cap in an hour, okay? That's exactly what happened. This idea that a single person or even just a few people in a company can make such an enormous difference, yeah, it was always true, but it's truer than ever. It's really truer than ever, and we're going to talk about some of that too. And then the third headline I also got this morning from CNN, completely different. It says, Candy Crush maker looks beyond mega hit. Now, I got to take a little poll in the room here, because some of you have no idea what that headline is talking about. And some of you really, really do know what it's talking about. How many people here play Candy Crush Saga? I want an honest answer, please. Okay. Several hands. A lot of hands went like this. Okay. So, all right. If you don't know, Candy Crush Saga is a game that you can play on your phone or on your tablet. You can download it for free. It is the number one download of any kind on Apple devices and Android devices worldwide and has been for a long time. It is just an unbelievably popular game. And so the story today was Candy Crush addicts have downloaded the mobile game 500 million times over the past year, but its creator is already thinking about how to replicate that success. Well, what's the point? Why do I mention this story? It's because of this. It's because of the business model. And like I said, it's free. You can download the game for free.
You can play it all you want for free. Where's the business model, right? How is this a business? Well, as some of you know, when you're playing the game, you can buy extra lives and extra points and stuff so that you can do better in the game. Now, you understand these lives and things have no meaning and no value outside the confines of the game itself, but you do spend real money to buy them, okay? Now, you and I would say, what a ridiculous idea for a business, right? Who is going to buy games, or lives and stuff, and this little game that all you do is play it? Why would, you know? All right. It's a private company for now. A consultant estimates that that Candy Crush brings in $900,000 a day from people buying these. By the way, how many people have bought lives and stuff on Candy Crush? Because now, come on. All right. And the other thing is, how many people believe that only losers buy lives on Candy Crush? Because there are people who think, you got to be careful when you talk about this stuff. The point is, it turns out to be an incredibly successful business model. The company that makes it, called King.com, is reportedly planning an IPO that will reportedly value the company at $5 billion. All right. Thinking about business models in a new way, in ways that you and I would think ridiculous, but that isn't ridiculous, is another big trend that we are seeing that we're going to talk a little bit about. All right, well, those headlines, like I say, set the stage for what we're going to talk about here the next little bit. I mean, I want to be clear. You're the experts on the many businesses that you're in. We got every kind of business here. You're the experts in your business, not me, and I can't stand here and tell you how to run your businesses. But the great thing about my job is I do get to travel around and talk to business people of all kinds, all over the country, all over the world. And I get to see some of what separates the great performers from the average performers. And there are some things that distinguish them, and I suspect that they will hold some relevance for you. I'm pretty confident they will. I want to ask you a question that's really a big question. It's this: what do you want most in your business life? Right? In whether you are involved in a company or whether you are involved in a city or a region, what do you want most? I've asked this of an awful lot of people, and the answers I get all tend to be basically the same. What people want is a sustainable competitive advantage. It always comes back to this one way or another, a sustainable competitive advantage. And I think the reason so many people say this is that you do get the feeling in today's world that no advantage is sustainable, because we see this everywhere. I mean, the great example, you know, the devices that we all carry around with us. Everybody here can remember when Motorola ruled the world of cell phones. I mean, absolutely dominated that business. And then Nokia did, and then BlackBerry did, and now none of them do. And last quarter, Apple and Samsung, between them, earned 105% of all the profits in the industry. Right. And by units, Samsung is now even bigger than Apple in smartphones. Well, that's five leaders in a global, multi-billion dollar industry in 12 years. Now, that never used to happen, but now it does. Nobody's advantage seems sustainable. And so everybody feels like, I wish I had something to hang on to. And we also want it because of the uncertainty that I talked about before. Times really are more uncertain, and it's not just generally in the economy. Policy uncertainty in particular, coming from Washington in particular, is a real problem, and that isn't just an impression. There are some smart economists at Stanford and the University of Chicago who developed a policy uncertainty index. They found a way to track this, and they tracked it back over the past 30 years. It's off the charts now. It really is greater than it used to be. And so in the uncertain environment, people just wish they had something to hold on to. Plus, I know every one of you is being asked to do more with less. It's the common story in businesses everywhere. In that, you just wish you had something you could hang on to. Where are you going to find your sustainable competitive advantage? Well, I do think there is an answer. Like I say, I get to talk to a lot of people, and I do think there's an answer. In particular, I've noticed four things that the great performers are doing now, and that's what I want to tell you about. I emphasize that they are not theory. They didn't come from a book. I didn't make them up because they sounded like they should make sense. They are what I see the best performing business leaders and businesses doing now. Before I get to them, I want to mention quickly two things that kind of are overarching, two things that overlay everything else. One is just the wise use of information technology. Okay, it has to be said, the IT tools are so incredible now, so much better than they used to be. We have to be really wise users of them to even be in the game. The thing is, they're not going to give you a competitive advantage, probably, because they're available to everybody. Those companies that make them will happily sell them to you and every one of your competitors. The difference is using them faster and more wisely than the other guy. The other big overarching theme that applies to everything we're going to talk about is culture. The corporate culture, the culture of the region, the culture of the organization. I hear more and more about this. I can remember when big deal CEOs didn't even want to talk about it. Culture was too soft and mushy. You couldn't measure it. It was not something that a big deal CEO worried too much about. And now they all seem to realize that that is key to the whole game. And there's a good reason that they think that. What is culture? What is a corporate culture? The best definition I ever heard is, it's what people are doing when nobody is telling them what to do. I don't know who came up with that, not me, but it's the best one I ever heard. What people do when nobody is telling them what to do. Well, in the old days, when we had an industrial economy with assembly lines and stuff, there was rarely a moment when people were not being told what to do. Every motion that they made just about was prescribed for them. Now that's not the case. We're all working with information. Nobody is telling the people in this room or the people who work for the people in this room what to do most of the time. What they're doing from moment to moment, they have goals, they have policies, but what they are doing from moment to moment increasingly is a reflection of the culture. And that turns out to be more and more important. Okay. So what are the four things that I see the best businesses doing now? First one, they are innovating the business model. Now, innovation is the hottest word in business now, but it's mostly about innovating products and services. This is something much more profound, innovating the business model. Let me take another poll in the room. How many people at some point in your life bought Kodak film? Right? Answer, everybody. How many people use Instagram? Answer is quite a few, but not nearly so many. How many are not totally sure what Instagram is? Right. Okay, several brave hands go up. Instagram is a photo sharing service online, and the reason it's interesting is, given the show of hands we had in this room, how can it be that Instagram, with 12 employees, was bought last year by Facebook for $1 billion, and Kodak is just leaving bankruptcy. Failure to innovate the business model turns out to be something nobody can afford to do. And the reason it's a big issue is that business models just don't last as long as they used to. And in fact, we see industries, companies, being forced to change them. Exhibit A is my business, magazines, right? We had a business model that worked great for 100 years. It doesn't work great anymore. And nobody in the industry knows what the next business model is. We see it also in all kinds of media-related businesses, but it goes way beyond that. Retail is being totally disrupted. Retailers, many of them, need a new business model, and they don't know what it is. I mean, maybe you saw that Target announced a new policy that says they will match the online price of anything they sell in their store. Well, you can understand that. The problem, as you know, is online prices change from moment to moment, constantly. So the rule is you got to show the checkout clerk what the online price is at the moment you're checking out. Okay. Now, suppose you got a basket with 20 things in it, right? Now, suppose you're behind the guy with the basket with 20 things in it, right? I don't know how this is going to work out, but I don't fault them because they have to try something. They've got to try to figure out what the new model is. The problem is that innovating the business model is not a competency that most companies have because they never needed to have it. A good business model used to work for years or decades. You could have generations of management that didn't need to change the basic model. It's not a competency that most companies developed. The trouble is that these models just don't last as long as they used to. I've spoken to consultants and CEOs, and they say, look, it used to be you could turn the crank on a good model for 30, 40 years, maybe more. Now, in some businesses, it changes every 2 years. If you can wait every 6 or 7 years, that's nirvana. So the difficulty is, if you've had generations of management that never had to change the model, why would we think that today's generation would know how it's done? This is fundamentally new and different. Companies are going to have to learn this competency, and some have done so. A good example is Intel, which makes the chips that go in most of our devices. They have changed the fundamental business model 5 or 6 times over the history of the company. You know, from memory chips to processing chips, then betting billions of dollars that they could brand those chips with the Intel Inside campaign. They have done it, but you never. So now they're trying to transition to chips that go in mobile devices. Another fundamental bet the company change in the model. We'll see if it works, and we don't know if it will. But at least there's an outfit that has developed the competency. It's a competency that we are all going to have to develop. And it's not going to be easy for some companies, but we all need to do it. The second big thing that I see the best companies, the best business leaders do now is they are integrating all parts of the business into one thing to create great customer experiences. Now, the way you know this is a big trend, and it's really big right now, is we see so many organizations using the same slogan for internal purposes. This is not for customers, this is for the employees. They're all using the same slogan. One Ford, one Cleveland Clinic, one Microsoft, one Carlisle. Everywhere you turn, they're using the same slogan. How come? It's because they're all feeling the same thing. They're all feeling frustrated. They've got all these great capabilities within the organization, and they know that they are not bringing them together to create the great, what they ultimately have to create, the wonderful customer experiences that will prevail in the market. And the problem is not that they don't want to do it. Of course they want to do it. The problem is they can't do it typically because of the way the company is organized. And in particular, at a lot of organizations, it's the way the top team is organized. The typical top team is a group of people who are revenue managers and cost managers. And those are important things, but the creative people, the ones who are actually doing the creative work that will create those fabulous customer experiences, they're in the company, but they're a few levels down. And by the time their work, their ideas, makes it to the top, it's gone through a few other people, and they aren't interacting with the other creative people in other parts of the company. And the result is that the big projects, the big initiatives in these organizations to create better customer experiences involve making decisions sequentially, not simultaneously. And the result of this is always two things. One, it's slow. And two, the final result is always suboptimal. It's just not what it could have been, because when you get to decision five, you realize that decision two should have been different, but it's too late to change it. The companies that are doing it well manage to bring all of these creative folks together and get them to interact, and somebody, sometimes it's the CEO, but it doesn't have to be, integrates all of that, puts it all together to create one experience. And the all-time champion at this was Apple. And I think a lot of the reason we're seeing this now is because people are responding to the incredible success of Apple. But Steve Jobs took every part of that business, the hardware, the software, the physical product design, the design of the online experience, and he had all of those people, and Tim Cook does the same thing today. All of those people come to a meeting every Monday morning for 4 hours to go over it all. He said, I couldn't create perfect products without everybody knowing everything. He got all of those folks together and integrated everything every week. And the result was these world-dominating customer experiences. It's not just Infotech where you can do this. A lot of Alan Mulally's success at Ford was actually doing the same thing. Others are doing it also. McGraw-Hill is doing it now in some ways. Lego, believe it or not, is doing it in some ways. Hershey. It can be done, but it is a fundamentally different way to organize an organization and a top team. The third thing that I see the best ones doing now is they never stop building their human capital. Now, every company says people are our most valuable asset, right? Every company says it. Most companies do not behave as if they actually believe it. The best ones really do. I mean, look, when times get tough, companies will reliably cut three things. They cut travel and entertainment. They cut advertising, which we at Fortune Magazine believe is a terrible, terrible thing to do. It's short-sighted and simply wrong. And they cut training and development. And they did it again in this recession. I've seen the figures. The best companies don't cut it. They understand that the human capital actually is the most valuable asset in the company. And it's true no matter what business you're in. I mean, look, I have a favorite question that I ask business people. Simple question, open-ended, not a trick question. I've asked it of thousands of business people around the world at this point, from the CEOs of the world's most valuable companies to a guy running a three-person brokerage office in South Dakota. Here's the question. What is the source of your operation's competitive advantage? Whether your operation is an office or a territory or a function or the whole company or whatever it is. What is the source of your operation's competitive advantage? I don't know for sure what you would say, but I can make a pretty good guess because everybody says the same thing. Everybody puts their head back and thinks about it and says, our people, our culture, our relationships. Everybody says it. And what's striking is what nobody says. Nobody has ever said to me, economies of scale. Even in huge companies that have tremendous economies of scale. Nobody has ever said patents, even at very technologically advanced companies with valuable patents. Everybody says the same thing. Our people, our culture, our relationships. Now, that's interesting because it tells you when people stop and think about it, they all realize where their competitive advantage really comes from. But if everybody says it, and everybody does say it, then it doesn't help us distinguish the winners from the losers. So I have a second question that I like to ask. Again, simple, open-ended, not a trick question. The question is, what is your organization's core competency? What is the thing that you do better than anything else, better than anybody else, that's the core of what you do? And not everybody gives the same answer to that one. If you ask at Google what's your core competency, they don't say anything about algorithms. They say hiring. That's what we really do. They understand what the scarce resource is. If you ask at General Electric, and I have asked the current CEO, Jeff Immelt, and the previous CEO, Jack Welch, the same question, separate occasions, years apart, they both gave exactly the same answer. What's the core competency? They didn't say anything about light bulbs or jet engines or any of the stuff they make. They both said evaluating people. That's what they really do at GE. They understand what the scarce resource is. The best companies understand that, and it doesn't matter what kind of business you're in. The best way to see that is to look at the two most valuable companies in the world right now, which are Apple and Exxon. Now, in the case of Apple, it's easy to see that human capital is the most important asset because that's practically all they've got. They don't manufacture anything that they sell. For assets, they've got their campus there in Cupertino, but, you know, and they've got now some retail real estate, but that's about it. What they've got is people, is human capital. It's easy to see in the case of Apple. But what about Exxon? This is one of the most physically capital-intensive companies on the planet. Okay, I was talking to their CEO, Rex Tillerson, some time ago. Now, at the time, Exxon had cash flow of about $52 billion a year. Okay, so after all the bills were paid, they had about $1 billion a week that they had to do something with. All right. And what they were doing, Yeah, they could send it to Omaha, you know. What they were doing at the time was they were investing about $20 billion a year in projects, refineries and oil wells and stuff. And the other $32 billion they were sending back to the shareholders in the form of dividends and stock repurchases. And I said, Rex, I don't understand this. You guys earn the highest returns on capital of any supermajor oil company. Why don't you invest more of that money in projects rather than send it back to the shareholders and build shareholder wealth that way? And he said, well, you know, you're right. Money's no problem. We got plenty of it. He says, the problem is I can't just go out on the street and hire the kind of engineers and geoscientists that we need to do the kind of projects that we do. And I said, you're telling me that the constraint is people? And he said, yeah, that's what I'm telling you. Even in the most physically capital-intensive company in the world, the critical production factor, the scarce resource, is the human capital. The best companies never forget it, and they never stop developing it. There's a lot to be said. We could talk all day on human capital development, but there's one point I want to make. What attracts and keeps the best people today is increasingly not what the company does, but how it does it. It is the purpose, the noble purpose that is inherent somewhere in every business. And to show it, I'm going to mention briefly two companies, what you might say on opposite ends of a spectrum. One end, Medtronic up there in the Twin Cities making these devices that go in people's bodies and save their lives. Now you could say, it's easy for them to be noble about what they do, right? Given what it is. Yeah, maybe so, but it's what they do with it that really makes a difference, and they do a lot with it. And as some of you may know, they hold a dinner every year. It's coming up in December, just for the employees. And they bring in patients from all over the world who have Medtronic devices in them. And over the course of the evening, one by one, they get up and tell their story. People of all kinds, children. By the end of the evening, everybody is crying. Now, they didn't talk much about shareholder value at Medtronic. They had some problems a few years ago. But over the past 40 years, there has scarcely been a better shareholder value creator in this country. And every CEO of that company that I've spoken to, and I've spoken to most of them, will tell you that dinner is the most important day of the year at the company. That's one end of the spectrum. The other end, a company I'll identify for you in a second, I want to quote one line from the CEO's letter to the shareholders. He says, "As for me, I am honored by the opportunity to lead what I believe is the most noble business on earth." Now, what's the company? Well, it's the Coca-Cola Company. Now, we all love the Coca-Cola Company, but if I'd said to you, "Name for me, please, the most noble business on earth," you might not have put your hand up right away and said, "I know that one, it's the Coca-Cola Company." But in fact, if you listen to them talk about all the millions of small merchants around the world who can make a living because they sell Coca-Cola products, and all the people touched by the vast Coca-Cola system and all the money they give to charities in every country on the planet, you start to see how they get kind of cranked up about it. And why the old CEO used to say, "We will not rest until the faucet with the letter C on it dispenses what God intended." The fourth thing that the best companies are doing is they are getting radically customer-centric. It's another thing that every business says, right? We are customer-centric. The customer is king. Most of them don't behave as if they mean it. In fact, most of them don't even really know what it means because they don't know how much money they make or lose with each customer. They don't understand the differing wants and needs of different customers. They don't create different offers to meet the differing wants and needs of different customers. And if they don't do all of those things, then they aren't really customer-centric. The best ones are getting so. And in today's infotech environment, you can get incredibly customer-centric. This used to be hard. It was always a good idea, but it used to be hard. It isn't that hard anymore. You can do it. The all-time champ here, I think, is Amazon. In fact, their mission statement, used internally, they don't use it in the outside, but the mission is to be the Earth's most customer-centric company. And they may be. It's interesting that they have never analyzed customer segments. Most companies do that. You know, they divide their customers into segments. They never have. They only analyze individual customers. And of course, they have hundreds of millions of them now. But they nonetheless analyze each one as an individual and send offers to each one as an individual. It is possible to do that now, and the best companies are doing it. I have to say this is often a cultural issue in addition to a technological one. Many companies say proudly, everybody who comes through that door gets the same great service. But no, not everybody wants or needs the same service. They want the service that's right for them. Customer-centric companies treat different customers differently. And that is the essence of customer centricity. Okay, those are the four things that I see the best companies doing now. They innovate the business model. They integrate all parts of the company. They never stop building the human capital. They get radically customer-centric. An important point about all these things is they're out of the mainstream. If you're doing all of these things, you're going to feel a little different. You're not doing what everybody else is doing. You're not cutting where everybody else is cutting. You're changing to business models that competitors don't quite understand. You're going to seem a little strange. It takes courage to do these things. That's what's important. It takes courage to do them when they need to be done. And there's one last point I want to make. If all you do is read the headlines in the newspapers today, you can get kind of depressed. Okay? Most of the news seems bad. It's easy to think that the country is going in the wrong direction. Okay? I want to tell you that I don't feel that way. I am tremendously optimistic. You don't read this stuff in the papers generally. Maybe it's a good thing. News is what's bad, right? I mean, news is what's unusual, and if the bad is unusual, that's good. But I travel all around, and I tell you, we have so many advantages here. We have so many reasons to be hopeful. A very specific one is all the oil and gas development that is starting now. That is a gift to this country. It is going to transform our economy in ways we can't even imagine. We have a tremendous demographic advantage. Yes, we're aging, but we're not aging like the rest of the world. Sweden, Japan, Italy, those countries are in desperate trouble. Even China is. Russia is. We have a big advantage. And above all, we have a cultural advantage. We have a culture that embraces risk-taking, that looks past failure, that roots for the underdog. Most places don't have that, and we do. We still do, and it is a tremendous advantage. History says the pessimists have always been wrong. Optimism has always been the right way to bet about this place, and it's the way I'm betting. So, take courage. You need it, and you should have it. You have reason to have it. Take courage. Think of it this way. Even in this uncertain environment, somebody's going to win. It might as well be you. It's an honor to speak with you. Thanks, everybody.
You've been listening to a program from the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce on Noon Forum. We've heard the keynote address given at the Chamber of Commerce 2013 Economic Outlook Luncheon. The guest speaker was Jeff Colvin, senior editor-at-large at Fortune magazine. He spoke on the topic, Leading Ahead of What's Next. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, November 19, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jane McCain, special events senior coordinator at the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.